Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the ruling by a U.S. bankruptcy judge that Detroit is eligible to enter bankruptcy and can impose cuts to its municipal pension obligations. We will speak with G. Marcus Cole, a professor at Stanford University School of Law who specializes in bankruptcy, and discuss the fate of pensions that were previously considered inviolable, as public employees are now being scapegoated for the financial mismanagement of elected officials. Then we'll discuss the role of public banking as an alternative to Wall Street, which is how municipalities around the world raise funds, and speak with Mark Armstrong, a business development and communications consultant and the executive director of the Public Banking Institute. We'll discuss how the state of North Dakota finances public infrastructure through its public bank, and Mark Armstrong's article at Occupy.com, How America Can Replace Wall Street Financing with Public Banks. Then finally, a leading Israeli journalist, columnist for Haaretz, and commentator on Israeli public television, Ari Shavit, joins us in the studio to discuss his new book, My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. We'll talk about the existential fear Israel has from the outside and the moral rot its occupation policy causes on the inside, and discuss today's threats from the EU to cut off funds to the Palestinians if peace talks fail, as Secretary of State John Kerry meets with Prime Minister Netanyahu and begins the latest effort to revive the peace process. And joining us now is G. Marcus Cole, a professor at Stanford University School of Law, specializing in bankruptcy, corporate reorganization, and venture capital. Welcome to Background Briefing, G. Marcus Cole.
Thank you for having me.
And the judge, Stephen Rhodes, in Detroit, the U.S. bankruptcy judge, in saying that Detroit is eligible to proceed with bankruptcy, and of course it is being appealed, but it does appear that he's also opening the door for the city of Detroit to impose cuts on its municipal pension obligations. Is that something new? Because it didn't happen with Vallejo and Stockton. So I'm wondering whether this could have a ripple effect.
It could have a ripple effect. We can't say that there's a new statute or anything that brings this about, but this is a relatively recent consideration by municipalities filing for Chapter 9. This is not a route that they've taken to cut pensions. But the discussion in Vallejo opened the door, really, for municipalities that have been beset by the burden of extensive pension obligations to consider Chapter 9 as a possibility. So as an approach, it's new, relatively new, but it's not something that municipalities have done before.
Well, we know that also in California, this San Bernardino is chafing under its $24 million a year CalPERS bill. So what do you think this will – how do you think this will affect to San Bernardino?
Well, so the decision to restructure pension plans is going to be a difficult one, particularly for San Bernardino, because CalPERS isn't just a pension fund. It is one of the world's largest institutional investors. And so a municipality that's confronting the possibility of having to cut or restructure its pension obligations has to consider the fact, particularly for California municipalities, they have to consider the fact that CalPERS is a very powerful institutional investor who is also a major player in the purchasing of municipal bonds. And so it's a minefield, really, for municipalities, particularly in California, to consider cutting their pension obligations or restructuring the pension obligations, knowing that they may have to, at some point in the future, look to CalPERS and other pension funds to purchase their municipal bonds when they want to raise revenue.
So the fact that this U.S. bankruptcy judge, Stephen Rhodes, issued this ruling, which specifically what he said is that the pension promises made to employees can be treated essentially the same as any other business contract, meaning they can be impaired, which is, of course, is the euphemism in bankruptcy lingo, I believe, for being reduced.
Yes, but actually that's an understatement, because municipalities filing for bankruptcy under Chapter 9 actually have more power to restructure their contracts, their executory contracts and other obligations than a corporation restructuring under Chapter 11. The judge in a Chapter 11 case always has a very, very big stick that he or she can use with respect to a debtor who's trying to restructure, and that's the stick of liquidation. So the restructuring plan in a Chapter 11 for a corporation has to satisfy certain benchmarks in order to be approved, and if it doesn't, then the judge can order a liquidation of the company. A judge in a Chapter 9 case can't do that. A Chapter 9 case is a lot like an individual consumer bankruptcy case in that we don't liquidate individuals who are burdened with debt, and we can't liquidate municipalities that are burdened with debt. So there's not a lot of weight behind the stick that the judge can use with respect to a municipality. And because of that, the municipality has more leeway. On top of that, there's also a constitutional consideration, and that's that the 10th Amendment to the Constitution gives states and their subdivisions certain standing that the federal government, even a bankruptcy court, can't interfere with. And so there are some limitations with respect to the judge's power in a municipal bankruptcy that they don't have in a regular corporate Chapter 11.
Again, I'm speaking with G. Marcus Cole, who's a professor at Stanford University School of Law, specializing in bankruptcy, corporate reorganization, and venture capital. So is that to say, then, that the retiree groups that argued against the city's Chapter 9 bankruptcy, who obviously lost, who are now appealing, does that constitutional provision under the 10th Amendment give them some leeway?
Or hope, possibly, but not much. The real choice before the bankruptcy court is whether to allow the city of Detroit to propose a plan that allows it to restructure its obligations in a way that satisfies all of its creditors in some way, or kicks the entire case out of bankruptcy and then allows the all of the creditors to have at the city of Detroit through the regular state debtor-creditor process. And neither of those approaches guarantees the pensioners the fulfillment of the pension promises that were made to them. So while they may fare better under a state process where the plan is, where the city's case is kicked out of bankruptcy court, there's not a lot of hope in this situation with regard to these pension plans.
So, G. Marcus Cole, a lot of people are feeling that public employees are being scapegoated for the financial mismanagement of elected officials. Is this, in fact, the case, do you think?
Well, in some ways, public employees are now confronted with the realities of the circumstances under which they bargained for their contracts. So unlike auto workers or other employees of private corporations, public employees are basically negotiating with politicians who have very little or no long-term accountability for their decision-making. So whereas a corporate CEO or other executive has to make decisions, and even if those decisions seem to be short-term in nature, there is long-term accountability because the net present value of the company is reduced by anything that they give away in the future. That's not true for politicians. Politicians can give away the store in the present and suffer no future accountability, and that problem is exacerbated in California, where we have term limits. So politicians know that they're only in office for a particular period of time, and they can make deals that in the long term might not be in the best interest of anyone. And now public employee unions are starting to confront the reality that sometimes when they're getting something from the other side of the table, they might not be getting what they're bargained for because of the prospect of municipal failure.
So, G. Marcus Cole, what is the role then of, in terms of, you've made a very good point that politicians aren't really accountable in the long term, but one of the phenomena that I understand is going on with these municipal governments around the country is that they're borrowing a lot of money from Wall Street. And you have the case of Jefferson County, Alabama, that spent $5 billion for a sewer project that was estimated at the real cost of $250 million. And then in California, you've got the case of the Canyon High School in Napa Valley that took out a $22 million loan payable in 2049, which will end up costing them $154 million. So are there any other alternatives for municipalities who want to build the infrastructure or buildings or whatever they want to spend their money on? Are they forced to go to Wall Street and make these sweetheart deals at the front end that end up costing them an arm and a leg at the back end?
Yeah, so Jefferson County, Alabama is a really interesting situation because what they did in that circumstance was try to provide themselves some insurance against increases in interest rates. And so they bought credit default swaps, which are basically insurance contracts where if the anticipated risk event comes true, then someone else bears the risk. But if it doesn't, then you bear the cost. And that's what happened in Jefferson County, and they simply miscalculated very badly. And unfortunately, that's not a situation where public employees or public employee unions were involved in creating the crisis. That was just bad management. And unfortunately, now there are whole groups of people, taxpayers, public employees, and others who are going to suffer because of that. And other municipalities suffer the same consequences with bad financial decision-making. But at the end of the day, Wall Street is actually a partner in trying to help municipalities raise the funds that they need for infrastructure and other capital investments that they wouldn't be able to raise otherwise. And so ordinarily, Wall Street is a friend to municipal governments and taxpayers who are trying to accomplish something without having to raise taxes. But Wall Street is no guarantee against bad financial decision-making or commitments by elected officials.
So in terms of this huge, crushing weight of debt of $18 billion that Detroit has, you know, there have been some discussion of selling off the art collection. Apparently, the latest estimate is it's worth $2 billion. I believe the judge, the U.S. bankruptcy judge, ruled that out, saying it was, I suppose, it was a drop in the bucket, right? $2 billion out of $18 billion. So what's your sense then, as somebody that's a specialist in bankruptcy, of who's going to take the haircut here?
So I think this is going to be a really difficult problem to fix through the bankruptcy process, in large part because of the constitutional limitations that I talked about earlier. So, for example, the bankruptcy judge can't force the city of Detroit to sell City Hall, and they can't force the city of Detroit to raise taxes. So unless the city can come up with a plan on its own that raises the kind of revenue that's necessary to address a lot of its debt, it does face the real prospect of having to deal with the creditors under state law. Now, what I think is likely to happen is that the city will try to meet the creditors halfway, including the pensioners, by trying to come up with various devices to raise revenue both in the short and long term. One of the things that's foreclosed at this point is the possibility of raising revenue through issuing more municipal bonds, because essentially Detroit's credit rating is now non-existent, and so their revenue-raising options are limited. But I do think it's in the city's interest to try to meet the creditors halfway, but I think everyone with a stake in the fiscal affairs of the city of Detroit is going to take a haircut.
Well, J. Marcus Cole, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with G. Marcus Cole, who's a professor at Stanford University School of Law, specializing in bankruptcy, corporate reorganization, and venture capital. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the role of public banks around the world and in the state of North Dakota as an alternative for cities to raise funds.
Send me a postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer, fill in a form, mine forevermore. Or will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Banks falling, presidents scratching his head. Wall Street about to lose them. I mean, up and down, gas prices up and down. Nobody knows what to do. You know what we need, though? Money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Armstrong, a business development and communications consultant and the executive director of the Public Banking Institute. He has an article at Occupy.com, How America Can Replace Wall Street Financing with Public Banks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Armstrong.
Thank you, Ian.
And obviously, with the bankruptcy of Detroit, with the judge ruling that Detroit can now impose cuts on its municipal pension plans, that, of course, seems like cruel and unusual punishment to public employees who are essentially being scapegoated because of the mismanagement by elected officials, many of whom turned to Wall Street for their projects, etc., and end up, you know, basically being gouged in ways that are unbelievable. So let's talk about how some of these cities, I mean, in the case of Detroit, do you have any information of exactly why they have gotten into this situation where I believe their obligations are, what, they're buried under about $18 billion in debt?
Right. Well, you make a very good point that elected officials are kind of forced into dealing with Wall Street bankers. And that's because they have very few options. You know, they can't raise taxes in order to fund a project or fund XYZ type of program. They can't cut certain city services. That's already happened. And many cities and municipalities are bonded out. Now, some municipalities take the approach of doing privatization. They sell off public assets. So that's a fourth alternative. But really, the conversation in municipalities is around any one of those four alternatives. And in order to fund, you know, whatever it may be, these guys do turn to, the elected officials do turn to Wall Street bankers to solve that problem, which is quite beneficial to Wall Street bankers, especially when the county or city treasurer has already deposited public tax revenue into that very same Wall Street bank. And so they have our public monies and they're in the driver's seat, and then they can tell us what the terms are in order for us to get those deposits back in the form of loans. And so what we assert is, you know, there's a fifth option, and that is to create public banks where the tax monies and tax fees or other fees are deposited. And then because it's a public bank and it's got all the advantages of a bank, it's got lower cost of funds and access to other forms of capital, it's in a, it, the elected officials are then in a driver's seat and can actually avoid getting in the situation that the folks in Detroit are in, which is now, as you're saying, the pension plans could be carved up in this bankruptcy case, assuming it goes that way. It was appealed, so you know we'll see what happens. But you know this is happening across the country, and San Bernardino is in line as well. So you know, we really do want to avoid the situation where public employees who have contributed to these pension plans over the years, and there's a contractual commitment on the part of the government to pay those people a decent retirement wage. And in Detroit, it's only $19,000 a year, but that money was generated by the workers, and they have a right to it. And now that right is going, they're going to have to stand in line along with very well-paid Wall Street bank attorneys who are going to try to get money for their clients.
Well, just some of the examples, though, of Wall Street gouging these counties who go to them for money. Jefferson County in Alabama, for a sewer project that cost $250 million, they ended up paying $5 billion to Wall Street. And then you've got this school in Napa Valley, the American Canyon High School, where the district took out a $22 million loan payable in 2014, which will mean that this school will end up costing them $154 million.
Right. I'm familiar with that report. California Watch came out with that report for the Napa Valley School, as well as all other schools in California. And the numbers are astounding. When you look at the principal that's been taken out over the last 6 years, it was $9 billion. Across California to fund the building of high schools, things like that, which are kind of important. And what the deals, these are called capital appreciation bonds, and these are a product, this is a toxic product generated by Wall Street investment banks. And the idea is, hey folks, you don't need to pay this now. You can pay it 30 years down the road. It's actually going to be the next generation of taxpayers who are paying it. And that $9 billion that we're using right now to build schools is going to be turned into a $36 billion debt service payment within 30 years. And so, you know, this is just anathema to common sense. I mean, why would you even consider borrowing money when your children are going to have to pay that amount of money back for the use of the money today? And so, again, we get ourselves into this position because, and this is our assertion, that all of public finance in California, as well as in 49 of the 50 states, has been completely co-opted by investment banks, Wall Street investment banks. It's been privatized. And the only state that serves as a model to do it differently is the state treasurer takes the tax revenue and fee revenue and puts it into their own public bank. This is done by North Dakota, but it's also done by most countries across the world. The United States, Canada, and England are the only exceptions. So this is the norm that most governments do across the world, and we've been hoodwinked into thinking that, you know, we can't trust elected public officials to manage our money, and so we should give them to Wall Street bank sharks. And so, you know, of course, you're going to have a situation like Detroit happen where you've got the worst combination. You've got Wall Street investment bankers, you know, and they're very well-paid attorneys who are convincing the federal bankruptcy court judge to have access basically to public employee pension funds.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Armstrong, a business development and communications consultant and the executive director of the Public Banking Institute. He has an article at Occupy.com, How America Can Replace Wall Street Financing with Public Banks. Now, the public bank, the Bank of North Dakota, apparently they issued a $50 million loan to fund a new water pipeline. And the paid interest on this loan is reported as profits to the bank, and it gets returned to the state general budget. benefiting the same people who paid for the water. So that's just a win-win.
Right. It's a closed circuit, and that's the nature of a public bank. The interest payments are returned back to the very same people who paid them. Whereas when you have a more extractive Wall Street economy, the interest payments are made to a very small number of people who then stash it out, offshore in their own accounts. And so, you know, it's just makes so much more sense to keep our public tax and fee revenues local, to deposit them locally, whether at a state, county, or city level, into public banks, and then use those deposits to invest in either infrastructure, in that example you just gave with North Dakota, or in commercial loans, student loans. There's lots of examples. And North Dakota has really led the way in defining what the loan portfolio should look like. So our vision is along those lines of creating 50 state-owned public banks, as well as countless county and city-owned public banks, all of which are using public tax revenues. This is money that you and I pay, and instead of having them be put into Wall Street investment banks, we then turn around and loan them back to us, you know, put them into our own banks and use it locally.
Well, just in closing, Mark Armstrong, it looks as if Judge Stephen Rhodes in Michigan has opened up a real can of worms here, because we know that other cities like Vallejo and Stockton have gone bankrupt without going after the pension plans. But now Detroit is able to cross that line. And you mentioned San Bernardino. They're waiting in the wings. They're chafing under the $24 million a year CalPERS bill. And they're in court with CalPERS, who are trying to they're still paying, but they're $14 million behind. So are we going to see more raids on pensions?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how this turns out. I wouldn't exactly call it a raid on pension plans. What's going to happen is in this situation of a bankruptcy, you know, the pension plans are going to be on the table and they're going to be carved up. And you know, I don't know how much lower than you can go than $19,000 a year for Detroit pensioners. I mean, you know, do you cut it in half? I mean, that it just starts getting to be incredibly small amounts. So it's really hard to predict how that will turn out. But, you know, there is an alternative. That's what we maintain. And it starts with county treasurers and state treasurers and city treasurers putting that public money into public banks. And we can avoid this whole situation, which is getting more and more dire, as you're indicating.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mark Armstrong.
Right. And more information can be found at friendsofpublicbanking.org.
Well, thank you, Mark. Again, Mark is a business development and communications consultant and the executive director of the Public Banking Institute. He has an article out at Occupy.com, How America Can Replace Wall Street Financing with Public Banks. We're going to take a brief station break and be joined in the studio by Israeli journalist and author Ari Shavit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Ari Shavit, who is a leading Israeli journalist, a columnist for Haaretz, and a commentator on Israeli public television. His new book just out is My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Shavit.
Pleasure to be here.
And we're speaking at the very moment when Secretary of State Kerry is arriving in Israel His aide, General Allen, has been there for some time working on the deal. We may have something of a paradox here in American politics where the current Secretary of State is on a roll. He's getting things done, and his predecessor is going to run for president. Go figure. But, you know, we know there's a peace process and there's no peace. Can that be broken, that lie?
You hit it right on the nail. My concern, look, I'm a great admirer of Secretary Kerry's determination and moral commitment. I think that he's absolutely right in realizing that the two-state solution is slipping away and that action must be taken immediately. And I admire the risks he's taking, the resources he's putting in. He's a real, I don't know him personally, but from all I see, he's a real noble person trying to lead a noble initiative. And yet, I'm worried. And I'll tell you what my worry is. I think that the chances of striking a final status agreement, a real peace, within a few months, as the Secretary is committed to do, this is, in my mind, highly unlikely. I hope to be proven wrong. I'll be the first one to rejoice if the Secretary succeeds. But I dread the implications of failure. We've seen the implications of failure in 2000 when President Clinton did the same thing. He was very noble. He spent amazing resources. He became a master of all the details of the conflict. He took the parties to Camp David. He took an amazing risk. And the consequence was not peace, but terrible war. So I think that we have to learn from history. And my advice and wish is to prepare a plan B. Because if, God forbid, Secretary Kerry fails, and in a few months' time, by spring or early summer, this initiative will collapse, the results, I don't think we'll go back to war immediately, but I think we will see a terrible political crisis, and the result will be that Israelis will feel betrayed, Palestinians will feel betrayed, and the American Secretary of State will feel betrayed, and therefore he himself and the next secretary will not want to touch this. So my wish is let's plan a plan B. So in case this doesn't work, there is a fallback option, because otherwise the consequences might be dramatic.
So what do you make then of the EU pressuring the Palestinian Authority, threatening to cut off aid? Now, we know that the United Nations is having problems meeting its bills for the Palestinian camps, which have been going on forever and have created this culture of dependency. But because of what's happening in Syria with the massive humanitarian crisis where a third of the population is displaced, the money's being squeezed both at the EU and at the UN. So what's the point of putting pressure on the Palestinians? That's almost to suggest that they're certainly a part of the problem, but are they the problem?
Well, I think I understand the ones who are trying to deal with all parties with a kind of carrot and sticks approach. And I think probably this is why the Secretary and the Europeans believe that perhaps they have a chance right now because they have bigger sticks and bigger and sweeter carrots, and they're trying to play with that. That's legitimate, you know, that's part of diplomacy. Diplomacy in the Middle East cannot be naive. It must be assertive diplomacy. If you want, when President Carter reached the peace agreement, the historic peace agreement in 78 and 79 between Israel and Egypt, it wasn't easy. It wasn't. There are no flower children in the Middle East. Not Israelis, not Palestinians. You're dealing with rough players, cunning players. You have to be sophisticated and realistic in dealing with them. So I don't mind some pressure being put, but my concern again is that will be within the context of something that is workable. And my great concern is that the Palestinians right now are too, even if they want to strike the grand deal, and I have some doubts, but assume they want to, they have real difficulty. They are too weak now with the Arab Spring and the Arab chaos that followed. any moderate Palestinian leader, by the way, any moderate Arab leader, lacks the legitimacy needed to strike the grand deal, to make the real compromises on Jerusalem and the right of return. The last person who really had that authority was, ironically, Yasser Arafat. But it didn't work out with him. I don't know if he wanted it, but he was the Palestinian revolution. He could have made the historical compromise. I doubt it if Mahmoud Abbas and others, they are just too weak. They are moderate people. I doubt. Now, the same applies to the Israelis.
By the way, if they're also divided. They're divided, too.
Of course. It's complicated in everywhere. But the same applies on the Israeli side. I doubt it whether Prime Minister Netanyahu and the government are willing to go for the grand deal. But say they are willing, right now the political circumstances are such that it will be very difficult for them. So let's plan a plan B, something more moderate, more gradual, that can be applied and move us in the right direction towards a two-state, what I call two-state state, rather than a two-state solution, that will improve the conditions on the ground and enable us to reach the grand deal later on. But again, I'd be very happy to be proven wrong, and I'll be the first one to congratulate the secretary if he proves me wrong.
Again, I'm speaking with Ari Shavit, who is a leading Israeli journalist, a columnist at Haaretz, and a commentator on Israeli public television. His new book just out is My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. And this book, by the way, has gotten some of the most amazing reviews. I mean, they're like Valentines, for God's sake. But the New York Times described it as the book ultimately becomes a book of lamentation, a moral cri de coeur. So tell us about then the inherent duality that you bring out in the book between occupation and intimidation, the point being that Israel is unique in as much as it has existential threats surrounding it. At the same time, it's created this condition of occupation and colonialism that's eating at its moral heart.
I thank you for the question, but let me refer first of all for the reviews. Really, I'm so blessed for the way the book was received so far. I'm so thankful to all these great people. But I think that although I love my book and I hope I have something to contribute, I think it shows that there was a wish, there was a thirst, a hunger to hear some new kind of voice coming out of Israel. And I think that the way the book was embraced so far shows that it answers a certain deep need in this country. You know, people told me years ago while I was writing it, you know, no one will be interested. You know, Israel is off the map. So people are so tired. Yes, people are tired of the old conversation about Israel. And I think what the book offers, and I try to offer myself, is a new kind of conversation, which leads me exactly to your point. My claim is that anyone dealing with a conflict there who has a simplistic idea is wrong. The reality is very complex. So first of all, if you come with a simplistic idea, you're wrong. If we all agree that it's so complex and try to deal and wrestle with the complexity, then we begin the real deal and dealing with the real issues. And the basic complexity is exactly the one you mentioned, which is that on the one hand, it's unbearable, and I find it outrageous, that Israel is an occupying power. It is the only Western country, the democracy, that occupies another people. This is unbearable. This is wrong. On the other hand, one has to remember that Israel is the only nation on the face of this earth that is existentially intimidated. The danger to its existence is real. What we see generally is the people on the left, for good moral reasons, focus on occupation and tend to ignore intimidation, while the people on the right focus on intimidation and ignore occupation. I ask us all to unite around the whole thing. If we really see the two pillars of the issue, then we can deal with the issues seriously. And in my mind, if the world and the Israeli left and all the international peace movements will acknowledge the seriousness of intimidation, the fact that Israelis really have legitimate fears that are not just psychological, then we can actually deal with occupation. Because so far what has happened, because we offered the Israeli people only an all-or-nothing deal, and because we did not address their fears and their concerns, and we did not really deal with the intimidation seriously, they rejected all peace offers because they seemed to them unreal. If we come up with a plan that is realistic, that goes for a kind of new peace concept, that addresses the real threats to Israel, then I think we can actually convince the Israeli center, at least, and begin a real process that would end occupation.
But there is this other component, which we started out talking about, which is why the secretary is there. The U.S. is what? The referee, the sponsor, the ally. And I think one of the reasons why your book is being so well received is that American Jews, I think, 75% of whom are on the liberal side, I think are increasingly uncomfortable with the representation through AIPAC of only the right wing in Israel. And you've got these young journalists like Max Blumenthal writing books that basically are, because he's offended as an American Jew, having to take on all this baggage.
I see the issue and I see the challenge. I mean, the problem we've had in the last decades is that we've seen a growing, intensifying alliance between Tea Party America and Tea Party Israel. And what I come to say is, let's do exactly the opposite. Let's recreate and redefine and revive the alliance between non-Tea Party America and non-Tea Party Israel. I think this is needed. Definitely it's needed for progressive American Jewry, but it's needed for progressive America, not only the Jews, and it's definitely needed for the progressive Israelis, because only if we work together, again, with realistic ideas, but we really have shared values. We really do not want occupation. We really do not want an Israel that is ultra-religious and fundamentalist in some ways. I think Israel is not there. I think the battle is not lost. I think that this darker picture of Israel that we've seen in recent years, there are problems there, but the battle has not been lost. And therefore, if we work together, I think we can actually revive peace, and we revive the possibility of having a benign Israel that progressive Americans, Jewish or not Jewish, can be proud of and can actually celebrate rather than reject.
Again, I'm speaking with Ari Shavit, who is a leading journalist, a columnist for Haaretz, a commentator on Israeli public television, and his new book just out is My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. Now, in terms of the book, you talk about its settlement, and of course your great-grandfather was a British Zionist, and you say here, because obviously it started out as a sort of socialist experiment and is now largely dominated by the right, because former President Bill Clinton put his foot in his mouth by suggesting that Israel was inexorably moving to the right because of the influx of Russians, and that caused quite a stir, but clearly its politics have moved to the right. But you say all this idealistic socialism is just subterfuge, future critics will claim. It is the moral camouflage of an aggressive nationalist movement whose purpose is to obscure its colonialist expansionist nature. That's a tough...
That's
not you. That's Dwight Garner in the New York Times. I see. Sorry. He put it in quotes, so I thought he was quoting you.
I'll deal with the issue. Let me deal with the issue.
Right.
I'll tell you what I do believe. Israel, and I think this is part of the complexity that has to be resolved. Israel, in the beginning, was idolized. And the idea was really that it will be this kind of utopia. So you had the socialist dreams and you had the kibbutz. And people were not satisfied just with the idea of saving the Jews and giving the Jews a home, giving a homeless people a home at last. They thought it must be the perfect home. It must be paradise of absolute morality and justice. And many Jews and Zionists worked within that framework. That is gone. Israel is not a utopia, and it will not be a utopia. The kibbutz will not be back, and these great dreams that I have, I love those dreams, and I love those dreamers, but that will not happen. And yet, that does not mean that Israel is evil. And because that's the other side, people had such high expectations and wanted so much of it and held it for such high standards that when that did not happen, they moved to the other extreme. That's not fair. The Jews, the Jewish people, and the Jews who went to Palestine and turned it into Israel have a right for a home like any other nation. In some senses, more than any other, some nation, because they are the ultimate victims of the 20th century. They are the ultimate victims of Europe. To say about them that they are colonizers or evil is, in my mind, absolutely ridiculous, although they've done many, there were many wrongdoings. So let's get it right. What you do see in Israel today, and that's the good news, is you see a very free, robust society that is life-loving, innovative, creative. So let's connect to that, to the positive forces in Israel that are amazing, not only in high tech, which is talked about, but in any fields of life, in arts, in culture, in literature, in dance, what you name it. There are so many Israel who have such amazing vitality while living in this dangerous situation. Let's connect to them, relate to them, and bring these forces into the political, so we solve the unbearable political problems of occupations and the other ones. So don't, I find that people who moved from admiring Israel to hating Israel, I ask them to grow up and have be much more fair in their attitude to that country. Yes, criticize what must be criticized. Denounce the wrongdoing that you see. But at the same time, appreciate what is a remarkable human endeavor, because at the end of the day, these are victims and survivors and homeless people who build a home for themselves. And that has to be appreciated.
Well, indeed, I think, to be fair, the problems that you also point out about modern Israel, along with what you just said in terms of praising the achievements we share here in the United States, a growing disparity in wealth, a restless young who don't see the same opportunities that their parents had. You've had those massive demonstrations by the young. You know, it seems to me that these two countries, in terms of their real challenges, are absolutely entwined.
Absolutely. Let me tell you something. Two things that I have on my mind as you speak. One, in the past, we used to say in Israel, when we were so critical of our political system, you would say, why cannot we be like Americans? Well, what happened is that rather than we become like Americans became like Israelis, and your system is now so polarized and difficult that I wish, as someone who loves America and thinks we need a strong and benign in America, I wish that you'll get your problems sorted out. But the other element is that in Israel is that we went through this Americanization process, so to speak. As you said, we left behind our social democracy. We moved to capitalism in a rather brutal kind of capitalism. As a result is extreme inequality. So on the one hand, you have a very vital, impressive economy that is growing, low unemployment, high growth, quite a tiger, Israel is. On the other hand, the price is real inequality. In the 50s, we were so fragile and poor, there was much more egalitarian. And now we are not, and this is something we have to address. But again, you touched the right issue. The social protest in Israel in 2011, to me, gave a lot of hope. Because after many years of despair, of the people being cynical we did not see the vitality going into politics, what you saw in my mind is the most impressive of the world's social networks to social protest movements. The 2011 protest in Tel Aviv and then spread to the entire country, was civilized, peaceful, reasonable, not extreme. I've all the respect for the other protest movements, including the one you had here. But Israel was a phenomenal achievement in my mind of the Israeli civic society. So you saw there the potential of an Israel that, again, in a reasonable way, not in the idealistic old way, in the utopian way, but seeks social justice, seeks a lively democracy. So far, I'm disappointed by the translation of that into the political system. It did not. There were some changes, but not good enough. I hope that in the long term, that energy that we saw in 2011, that is there in the lively, young civil society in Israel, will transform the system and will actually bring back that Israel we want and push back the darker forces.
Well, it's been said that if Israel and the Palestinians were ever to settle their problems, which they almost did until Rabin was shot. And people forget that Israelis were shopping in Bethlehem and gambling at casinos in Hebron. And, you know, it was a different world. That worked for a while. And Leah Rabin still blames Netanyahu for her husband's death because there was a peculiar symmetry there between Netanyahu's hawkism and the sabotage of the peace by the Iranians. So you have that kind of paradox, don't you? And I'm not suggesting that they're the same, but they have in curious ways.
First of all, I think that I think that many mistakes were done by the Israeli right during that period, and some mistakes were done by Ms. Netanyahu, was then leader of the opposition. I think that the specific argument or claim that you just quoted is unfair. It's unfair because there were many problems throughout. And you know, I'm a peace lover, but I'm also a Democrat. And I'm very aware to the fact that you have, when you bring about peace, you have to convince the people and you have to go through a real process where people endorse it. You cannot just impose it. Without getting into the details, at that period that you mentioned, while there was an amazing breakthrough and there was hope for a while, but I think there were flaws throughout in the system. We did not do it the right way. So, again, my lesson from that is there are two lessons. One is what I told you before. Let's bring a realistic peace process that can work. But then once we do that, let's convince the people. Let's not impose it on them. I think, look, talking of my admiration for America, when I see my progressive friends in this country, the way they went out of their convenient, their comfortable homes in nice neighborhoods to go to difficult neighborhoods in Pennsylvania or other places to try to get people to vote and to get President Obama reelected. I don't see much of that kind of activity in the Israeli center left, in the Israeli, so to speak, peace elite. And I think it's time for us, those Israelis who want a liberal Israel, not only to count, to wait for America to impose it on Israel, not only to wait for some general who would save us from the masses. We have to go out there with a practical idea, a realistic idea, and convince the people that it's right for them. I think, by the way, this is what Rabin did. Rabin's greatest political achievement in 1992 was that he did just that. And Ehud Barak and his supporters did it for a while in 1999. But throughout, ever since then, we did not do that. So my plea is for the international community to have a realistic peace concept and for the Israeli moderates to work within the democratic system to convince the people to adopt peace, not to try to impose peace. Because if you try to impose, you get violent reactions from the other side.
But just to touch on your analogy about the Tea Party, our Tea Party, in alliance with Israel's Tea Party, what I was going to say about the idea that if there's a peace between Israel and Palestine, then the divisions in Israel then will become more prominent, the divisions between the secular and the religious. That's something I've heard for years. And the difference here is, of course, you've got Tea Party people in this country. And Mitt Romney said it in that tape that he was taped in about the 47% being freeloaders. The Tea Party believe that the rest of America are freeloaders, but the Israeli situation is the reverse. Secular Israelis subsidize the religious, do they not? And they subsidize the settlements.
Yes, although again it's a bit more complicated with some of the settlers whom I oppose, but are very creative people and they work and they have and they are in this sense they are very, you know, productive citizens, and there is the problem that you mentioned is more relevant to the ultra orthodox world. But let me say two or three things about it. One, there I'm hopeful as well. I think that if regarding the ultra orthodox, we progressive Israelis be very firm on the one hand and tell these people, we will not let you impose your values on us. We will not have you play around with segregation of women or gay rights or anything else. We'll fight you to the end on that. On the other hand, if we reach out to them as individuals, because the tendency in Israeli politics is either to surrender to the ultra-Orthodox or to hate them. I don't want to hate them. They are a minority. They have their own world. As long as they do not want to impose their values on all of us, I would like to encourage them to go out to work, to be integrated into the wider society, just like ultra-Orthodox people in Brooklyn do. So I think if we have this right approach of being very firm on the one hand, but opening our hearts to them as long as they integrate into our world rather than want to destroy our world, I think we can gradually, we will not solve this issue. There will always be tensions there, but I think that we can have a reasonable situation. And the settlers is a different issue, because this is the greatest mistake Israel has done in its history. I mean, in my mind, the settlement project is the most, really risks us. And in my book, I try not to do settler bashing, not to go after these people. On the contrary, I listen to them, I hear them, I have empathy to them. I try to understand their logic. But in the end of the day, I say to them and I say to you, if we will not deal with the settlement project, the settlements will kill us from within. So I hope we can find a peaceful solution there that will not be involved in civil war, God forbid, or anything like that. But this is something we must address and we must solve.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in studio, Ari Shavit, again, and leading Israeli journalist, a columnist for Haaretz, and a commentator on Israeli public television. His new book just out is My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One more light goes on.